Et ici maintenant, une science musicale très intéressante. Monsieur Mortimer Coupe, Mortimer Frank. Monsieur Mortimer Frank, auteur, critique, bibliothécaire, il vous parlera d'un orchestre très bien connu, la well-known author, critique, musical critic, and the librarian with the Toscanini Archives. And he will give us a very interesting presentation about the NBC Symphony Orchestra, but he will not talk about the Toscanini era. He will talk about the other conductors. Mortimer Frank.
Just have to get set up here, folks. Before I say anything, I would like to express my thanks to two ARSC members who helped make this talk possible, Michael Gray and John Samuels, both of whom provided me with material without which this talk would not have been possible. Obviously, when we say the NBC Symphony Orchestra, the first thing that comes to mind is Arturo Toscanini. It was formed for him, but by the end of the first season, that is the 1937-1938 season, it was clear that the project at NBC was going to go well beyond that, and NBC had a commitment on a far grander scale than simply providing an orchestra for Toscanini. And this was actually spelled out by the National Broadcasting Company in a book that it published as a kind of commemoration of the creation of the orchestra. Some of you may have seen it. It's roughly a 100-page book, and it contains pencil sketches of all 93 members of the orchestra, plus three conductors who initially led it, Pierre Monteux, Otto Roginski, and of course Toscanini himself. And to give some idea of what NBC's commitment was, I read from that book just for a moment. Quote, "Before the conclusion of Maestro Toscanini's series of 11 broadcasts, the National Broadcasting Company announced," and this is kind of announcing that it itself announced, it's kind of awkward, "the following great conductors to succeed him: Carlos Chavez, noted Mexican composer and conductor of the Mexico City Symphony; Howard Hanson, distinguished American composer and director of the Eastman School of Music; Arto Roginski, Pierre Monteux; Sir Adrian Bolt, conductor of the BBC Symphony in London; Bernardino Molinari, conductor of the Augusteo Concerts in Rome, thus assuring the continuance of the NBC Symphony broadcast through June 1938. There's a few curious things about that announcement. First of all, the only two conductors who are not identified as to their professional capacity are Roginski and Monteux, presumably because they had both led concerts with the orchestra prior to Toscanini's appearance. Monteux conducted three, and Roginski conducted three. There was also, what some people may forget, a seventh concert. It was actually the very, very first broadcast of the NBC Symphony, billed as a dress rehearsal, and that's kind of curious. It must have been an hour. It contained two works, the overture to Oberon and Ein Heldenleben, both conducted by Roginski. I don't know what it was rehearsal for. Ein Heldenleben never appeared on any of the other NBC Symphony programs throughout the year. The overture to Oberon did on a special benefit concert conducted at Carnegie Hall by Roginski for Austrian refugees, which was not broadcast. So I think that was probably a promotional stint by NBC more than anything else. What is clear, however, is that by the end of that first season, NBC had a very strong commitment to the orchestra and to other important conductors, even if Toscanini was to remain the centerpiece of the entire operation. Now, the big question is, who were they? Well, there were more than I shall mention this afternoon. But for convenience sake, and admittedly somewhat arbitrarily, I have divided some of them into three groups. And the first group I would call the all-stars, if you want to use sports terminology, or the superstars, if you want to use current day terminology. And they would include people like Pierre Monteux and Arthur Roginski, of course, Sir Adrian Bolt, whom I think was always a terribly underrated conductor, Dimitri Mitropoulos, Bruno Walter, George Zell, Fritz Reiner, Leopold Stokowski, Eugene Ormandy, Erich Kleiber, Leonard Bernstein, who was not quite a superstar when he conducted the orchestra, Ernest Ansermé, and Guido Cantelli, who of course was on his way to superstardom, but not quite there when he first appeared. In the second group, what might be called the old reliables, the major leaguers, but not quite the superstars, and some of you may quibble with some of these. And this includes Bernardino Molinari, Desiree Defoe, whom I also think was an underrated conductor, William Steinberg, Alfred Wallenstein, Emil Cooper from the Metropolitan Opera, Sir Malcolm Sargent, Hans Lange, Milton Cadens, Erich Leinstorff, Eisler Solomon, Nikolai Malko, and Robert Shaw. And then in the third group, we have what we might call curiosities. And again, this is a somewhat arbitrary title. The first is Dean Dixon, and I put him in that group simply because we know so little of his work. And he led three concerts with the orchestra. Unfortunately, most of them during the summer when it was assumed people's listening capacities were substantially reduced. I've never understood this, why the content of a program changed so radically and became, in quotes, pops during the summer. And the most substantial pieces that he did conduct were the Academic Festival Overture of Brahms, the Oriente and Oberon Overtures of Weber, the Classical Symphony of Prokofiev, and the Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture of Tchaikovsky. Second curiosity is Lauren Marzell. And you'll say, why might Lauren Marzell be a curiosity? Well, Marzell made his debut as a conductor with the NBC Symphony Orchestra at the age of 9. Those of you who read Fanfare magazine may recall an interview I did with Marzell about 4 years ago that was published there. And in the course of the interview, I asked him, how was it conducting Toscanini's orchestra at the age of 9? And with all of the modesty that Marzell could summon, he looked at me and said, oh, it's no problem at all. I was simply a little professional doing a professional job. Well, he did whatever the quality of the performance would be, and I would certainly like to hear it. He certainly played professional repertory. First program had the overture to, he didn't conduct the entire first concert on which he appeared. He appeared only, the only major work was the overture to the Flying Dutchman. But the following week, he conducted a program that included the Egmont Overture of Beethoven, the Mozart Symphony in G minor K550, and the Tchaikovsky Nutcracker Suite, a fairly substantial program for a pro, and certainly for a 9-year-old, quite demanding. Third curiosity is Walter Damrosch, who led one program. And again, this was during the summer, and the real meaty works on the program were the Cocaine Overture and Pomp and Circumstance number 1 of Sir Edward Elgar. I've classified Leonard Bernstein as the fourth curiosity simply because he was only 28 years old at the time when he appeared. He led two concerts, one of which was entirely devoted to Mark Blitzstein's Airborne Symphony, and the second one to the Haydn Symphony No. 102 and the Ravel Concerto, in which Bernstein also appeared as soloist. And frankly, I'd like to hear both of those performances simply to see what he did with the Haydn 102 when he was a young man, among other things. Fifth curiosity is the man who led more concerts with the NBC Symphony Orchestra than anyone, save the Toscanini, who led 231. And unless you're familiar with the history of the NBC Symphony, you won't know that it was Dr. Frank Black, who was the music director at NBC. There are a few other curiosities, but I'll skip over them. And I should tell you that I've skipped over many names simply because time prevents my reading them all off, and I don't want to make this talk sound more like a telephone directory. Now, the big question is, obviously, what does this all mean? Well, first of all, this is significant because all of these concerts are preserved. I double-checked this yesterday with Jerry Gibson, and he told me, yes, indeed, they all are at the Library of Congress, and they can be heard. That doesn't mean that all of them are in listenable condition now. Some of them may have to be transferred to tape, but according to Jerry, many are on tape already, and some are probably available for auditioning. So that in itself is significant. And secondly, and we may tend to forget this, and I think it's a terribly important point, these are live performances. If I may digress for a moment, the phonograph has become such a dominant and undoubtedly welcome thing in our lives that we sometimes forget there has to be a difference between live and recorded. I have been an academic for almost 30 years. I have stood in front of classes ranging from late adolescence to people who are septuagenarians. And about 15 years ago, I started to work in the field of broadcasting. I will tell you that talking into a microphone is very different from doing what I'm doing now, standing and talking in front of you. The fact that I have the luxury, and I think it is a luxury, among other things, of seeing an audience in front of me and being able to make eye contact affects how I will perform, in effect, as a speaker. If your audience is bored and you're not making contact, your performance suffers. If you're talking into a microphone, I know from firsthand experience that your performance suffers. It takes a long time, as I've discovered, to develop anything that might be reasonably well called a satisfactory microphone technique. I'm not even sure I've done it yet. From the many Toscanini live performances that I've heard, I know that he responded differently with an audience behind him. And as I will suggest to you today, it's quite possible that other conductors did as well. So the fact that these are live performances, I think, is terribly, terribly important, simply for the documentary value of that alone. Now, I would be unrealistic if I didn't say, having looked over nearly all of the programs that the NBC Symphony presented in its 17 years of existence, that there isn't some fluff there and there isn't a good deal of material that probably doesn't command too much interest. But that may be from my own peculiar angle of vision. I don't like to speak for other people. But the point is that there are many, it is clear, many, many important performances. And basically, you can divide these performances into two categories. First of all, major conductors performing repertory for which we have, so far as I know, no other readily available recorded evidence. Works we've never heard them perform, and certainly that's significant. Then, too, we have what we might call, and this is the second category, the glosses on their studio recordings. Conductors performing repertory that they did indeed record. But we must remember that, as I'll come back to this, a recorded performance is simply one performance, and as I've already tried to suggest to you, something that may well be far more synthetic than that which is live. Now, I think the third byproduct of all of this is in being able to hear these other conductors and knowing that they were there permits us to make some inferences about Toscanini. And since I'm in the middle, deeply in the middle, of writing a book about Toscanini, I can't help but throwing them in at this point. First of all, I think it's significant whom he did invite. He has been criticized in some quarters for repressing certain aspects of the modern repertory, but it's interesting to see that some of the conductors whom he did invite excelled in the very repertory that he himself was not conducting. People like Fritz Reiner, people like Ernest Ansommet, people like Dmitri Mitropoulos. Also, it shows, contrary to what some people have said, that Toscanini did have respect for other conductors. Some of you may know the story about how somebody made a derogatory comment about Ernest Ansommet's performance of Maurice Ravel's La Valse with the NBC Symphony to Toscanini. And Toscanini said, no, is different, but is good. He clearly did have respect, I think, for other conductors. And I think perhaps the most interesting thing here is to perhaps better ascertain the effects of the often infamous Studio 8H, not only on the work of other conductors, but on Toscanini's work as well. My basic feeling about that studio, having heard it in the best possible way outside of actually being there, is that you can apply to it what Mark Twain once said about Wagner. It's better than it sounds. What we know of 8H, particularly from some of the RCA recordings, is a very poor representation. I would not in any way pretend that it was an ideal place to hear music. Its acoustics were far too dry and flat for that. But it wasn't nearly so bad as the RCA engineers sometimes made it. And this raises another question. Because it was unresonant, because it was so dry, did this affect the tempos of other conductors? Did it cause them, as you would expect in a dry hall, to accelerate a pace that they would ordinarily favor. And if this is the case, does this explain perhaps some of Toscanini's fast tempos? I'll come back to that a little bit later. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the repertory involved, first of all, in the first category, works that no conductor ever recorded, and then a few of the works in the second category, the glosses on some important conductors' work. Some of you may recall, if you were longtime readers of High Fidelity magazine in its heyday, and when in its real heyday, I'm speaking of the days when Roland Gillette was editing it, I can't be precise about this, this is purely from memory, but many years ago, I'd say sometime between, the best I can do is around 1957 and 1960, it published a short but absolutely delicious article called Be Your Own A&R Man, and it was all tongue-in-cheek, and the suggestions included, for example, of Sir Thomas Beecham conducting Bruckner, Furtwängler conducting a rodeo, the Gershwin Piano Concerto played by Willem Bachhaus. My very favorite one was La Boheme featuring Alfred Deller. That's the question. Michael Beale just raised the question that I was about to raise and which the article never answered. Which role? If all of this sounds somewhat exaggerated and somewhat extreme, listen to this. This is from actual NBC Symphony broadcast. Bruno Walter conducting the Tchaikovsky Fifth, the Debussy Afternoon of a Faun, the Ravel Rhapsody Espagnol, and the Vincent d'Indy Istvar Variations. Sir Adrian Bolt conducting El Salon, Mexico. Dimitri Mitropoulos conducting the Fifth Brandenburg and the Haydn Symphony No. 80, which, as I'm sure most of you are aware, was hardly a piece one heard frequently in 1945. Erich Kleiber conducting the Borodin Second Symphony. Pierre Monteux conducting Frederick Delius's A Mass of Life. This is interesting. And these are performances one would very, very much like to hear. We'll go on to some others. I'll skip those. Desiree Defoe doing Ravel's Mother Goose Suite, which Igor Kipnis told me, he was present at that performance, and told me it's the finest performance of the Mother Goose Suite he has ever heard. Fritz Reiner conducting Hindemith's Mattheus der Mahler, the Rhenish Symphony of Robert Schumann, the Bartok Miraculous Mandarin Suite. Artur Ogynski conducting the Dvorak Eighth Symphony. Stokowski conducting the Hindemith Symphony in E-flat. And of course, leading the orchestra in the world premiere of the Schoenberg Piano Concerto with Edward Steuermann, which some of you may know was actually written for Oscar Levant. Guido Cantelli conducting the Haydn Symphony No. 88 and 94, Stravinsky's Song of the Nightingale, the Schubert Ninth, the Beethoven Fifth, the Bartok Music for the Strings Percussion of Celesta, Ernest Ansermet doing the Schubert Ninth, George Zell doing the Bruckner Ninth. These are some of the gems that one longs very, very much to hear because we otherwise cannot hear these conductors directing this repertory. I'll start with Zell. Nearly all of the programs, with the exception of that one I cited that contained the Bruckner Ninth, nearly all of those programs contain material that would have typified a concert that Zell might have led in Cleveland. A typical example, March 1st, 1941, the Fourth Symphony of Robert Schumann, the Symphony No. 97 of Joseph Haydn, and the Richard Strauss Till Eulenspiegel. Erich Kleiber leading the Schubert Third, the Beethoven Third and Sixth, and the Egmont Overture. And some of you may have forgotten that Kleiber did indeed make a recording of the Egmont Overture, and I was actually going to use it in this talk. It was made in 1932 for Telefunken with the Berlin Philharmonic, and my copy of it, it must have been cut with a very strange groove. I could not get it to play well, so I didn't use it. Fritz Reiner doing the Mozart Jupiter Symphony, which I would particularly like to hear in Studio 8H, just for my own curiosity, to see if he employed those huge rallentandi that he uses at the beginning of the movement when he recorded it in the Orchestra Hall with the Chicago Symphony. Bruno Walter doing the Mozart 35th and 40th, the Schubert 5th and 9th, the Brahms 1st and 2nd, the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, the Beethoven 1st, the Mahler First, and most interestingly to me, the Bruckner Fourth, which I would particularly like to hear, because the only Bruckner Fourth we have from Walter is a recording when, made in the deep twilight of his career when he was out in California and when in many ways he was, I think, a tired old man. And all of this is just scratching the surface. Now, I could go on and talk about this, but what I thought I'd do, first of all, because I don't want to run too long, is to let you have an opportunity to hear some two things in their entirety, both short, and then in between to let you hear some comparisons for some very special reasons that I'll talk about in a moment. First thing we're going to hear is a conductor performing repertory that he never recorded, Bruno Walter, leading the Overture to the Bartered Bride by Bedřich Smetana from an NBC broadcast of March 2nd, 1940. And let me suggest, if I may, a few things for you to listen to as you hear the performance. First of all, one of the things I often wondered about 8H was, did it tend to reduce bass? Did it tend to make an orchestra less weighty than, let us say, Carnegie Hall would? And the reason I wondered this was primarily because most of Toscanini's performances with the NBC Symphony Orchestra sounded less weighty than those that he gave in the, from what we can judge from recordings with the Philharmonic and Carnegie Hall. Note here that Walter, who among many characteristics was noted for the kind of weighty bass that he did manage to produce a fairly solid bottom in this performance. Note too that the NBC engineers, recognizing, this was the third season of the orchestra, recognizing the sonic deficiencies of the hall, perhaps studio was a better word to use, injected quite tastefully artificial resonance into the performance. Note that if you listen to most of the performance, it's conceivable that you might, in some respects, take it for a Toscanini performance. Toscanini gave two performances of this, and some of you may know one of them. One was rebroadcast by WRVR, the other was issued by the Franklin Mint about 3 years ago. Up until the coda of the piece, and then there is a sudden gear shift, a sudden relaxing of the pace that Toscanini never used. I've left all the announcements in so that you can get a sense of the context of the piece. This, interestingly and curiously, was the last piece on the program. We often think it's odd that Toscanini would end the concert with a relatively lightweight work or a shorter work that we think more appropriate for the beginning of a concert. Bruno Walter did it too. And I might point out that if you know Gene Hamilton's voice, you'll hear that he has a very bad cold, and whatever that's worth. And as a final comment, I happen to think, for whatever it's worth, this is a lovely performance.
What happened?
Nothing.
Carlos, help
Tom.
Nothing.
No announcement.
Is it? No.
Is that the coin?
There we go. Thank you.
Another composition by Smetana brings tonight's NBC Symphony broadcast to a close. The Overture to the Opera of the Bartered Bride. That was the Overture to the Bartered Bride by Friedrich Smetana. In acknowledgement of this applause, Bruno Walter is again coming back to the front and center of the broad stage on which the many members of the NBC Symphony Orchestra are manned.
All right, I'll stop it there. It stopped a few seconds too short. I let the applause in, not because I knew it would charm everybody, but because I thought it was interesting. If you've heard enough Toscanini broadcasts, you know there's a tremendous outburst of applause at the end, and it was often quite sustained and lasted for a long time. There's about 25 seconds of applause there. One of my questions is, was it promoted? Were they short of time? The broadcast for that season lasted an hour and a half. Did they have to fill in, or was it all spontaneous? It's simply a question. I have no answer to it. Next two examples I want to deal with, they're both quite short, they're both excerpts, is to deal with the effects of 8H on a performance, possible effects. The first example is to use the trio of the Funeral March from Beethoven's Eroica Symphony in two cases. One, from the studio recording, the last of two studio recordings made by Erich Kleiber, I believe around 1953, with the Vienna Philharmonic that has been recently issued on a compact disc. And then to take Kleiber's performance with the NBC Symphony Orchestra from January 10th of 1948. This is a fairly slow passage. You all know it quite well, I'm sure. Did the studio have any effect on Kleiber's performance? And did the studio have any effect on our perception of the performance?
Let's see. Hello?
I'm really good with machines. I want you to know. we've got the second, we've got the Eroica kind of example coming up now. This is the VPO, the studio recording. Now NBC. I picked those two performances with the halls in mind. The first one was made in Vienna's Große Musikvereinssaal, a big, resonant hall, and 8H, of course, we all know about. Theoretically, a performance in 8H should be faster. The trio lasted 2 minutes and 1 second in Vienna, 2 minutes and 7 seconds at NBC. Also, as you could probably hear, because of the flatter perspective of Studio 8H, it was a shallow hall, there is far greater clarity, particularly in the winds and the brass and the timpani. One more example, though, I think is worth trying here, because we can bring things a little closer in time. Many of you may be familiar with the recording Bruno Walter made in 1936, December of 1936, as pianist and soloist of the Mozart D minor concerto Kirchlisting 466. He also performed it as pianist and soloist with the NBC Symphony. Now, I'm not going to say anything about the piano playing, except I did discover one thing that I found interesting, and some of you may also, and I'll just pass it along to you now. Walter always performed the second subject at the piano somewhat, I thought, eccentrically. He's the only pianist I ever know who gave very short shrift to a very significant grace note, you know, dun-dum-ba-dum, ba-da-dum-bum-bum. That C as a grace note, he just always glided right over. He did it at NBC as well. That was his way of playing it, whatever you happen to think of it. What I want to deal with here is simply the opening orchestral tutti. Hear it in both performances, the one recorded in Vienna in 1936. Again, so far as I can tell from the acoustic, the Große Musikvereinssaal, very resonant, and then in Studio 8H. And we'll hear some interesting differences. Carlos, start this damn thing. We did not plan it this way. Thank you. The studio recording of 36 first. Studio 8H in 1939. Thank you. you may have noticed that there was no artificial resonance in that transmission. This was the year before. You obviously also noticed the great clarity that 8H produced, particularly vis-a-vis the Viennese performance, Viennese recording, large hall, winds, brass, syncopations in the first movement were all heard to much better advantage here rather than that earlier studio effort. And things like this affect our perception of the performance. The NVC performance seems to be, if I can say this, more Sturm und Drangish, more demonic in a sense. And it seems faster, is it? Everybody, now I've really, well, here are the timings. The VPO performance, what you heard was 2 minutes and 13 seconds. The NBC was 2 minutes and 7 seconds. It is a little bit faster. It seems faster than that. And one of the reasons why is a truism we often hear, but I think we take for granted, it really shouldn't be a truism at all. Clarity creates an illusion of speed. The clearer something is, the faster it seems to be played. Here, because of the greater clarity, because of the more exposed, more sharply focused detail, as it were, you hear more of the performance, and it seems to be moving much more quickly than in reality it really is. Carlos, I have a question. I had one more example, and I'm looking at my watch. It runs 4 minutes, and it's an entire movement of a Haydn symphony. Do we have time for it?
I figure if we can keep on going straight through, we'll start the next one.
Yes.
We will not have any break whatsoever. As soon as this is finished, we'll continue immediately. So please, Manuel Goulart and Dick Stein, you come here as soon as you are through.
Fine. If this is causing any problems, I can just summarize now. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. The last example, I don't think it would be, because of my own, perhaps, prejudices, fair to present the other conductors of the NBC Symphony without including something of Guido Cantelli. And because I so much admired and still do admire his studio recording of the Haydn Symphony No. 93, I thought it might be nice to hear some other Haydn. So what you're going to hear is the finale of the Haydn Surprise Symphony in its entirety, and I make two brief comments about it. You all know that if you follow Toscanini, certainly that's one of Toscanini's least satisfying Haydn performances, it seems to me. Most unsatisfying in many ways. This strikes me, having heard the whole performance, as the kind of performance Toscanini might have given had he conducted the work, which he did not, with the New York Philharmonic, possibly in the years, say, 1930 to 1935. Here it is, the finale of the Haydn Symphony number 94 from a 1949, December 24th, 1949 broadcast with Guido Cantelli. And I did it this time. Cantelli.
Thank you.
Obviously, Cantelli did not let us forget the symphony's German title, the real surprise, the Symphony mit der Pappenschlager. A few summary comments. I think there is a treasure sitting in the Library of Congress for somebody to look at and look at very carefully. What we have there is the possibility not only to increase our depth and perspective on the performance practices of a number of very important musicians of this century. But we have the opportunity to relearn something that we should all know already, that no recording is ever definitive. No recording represents a particular conductor's way with a given piece necessarily. Any conductor who is a significant musician, and most of all, a thoughtful musician, will be continuously thinking about the music he performs, and as a consequence, changing his views of that music. More than anything else, study of this material may remind us that the recording that these conductors have left us is simply the view of the moment. And certainly, for the repertory that they never recorded, these live performances are invaluable. Thank you all very much.